call the next case, please. You may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm McNellis Powers, and I am here representing Charles Hawkins in this matter. Facts are pretty straightforward. Mr. Hawkins was arrested at Big Daddy's in Portsmouth on outstanding warrants after a tip that he would be there. He was described, the police arrived. He clearly meets the description of the person that the tipster said would be there. He is then apprehended, and this is where the case gets a little bit interesting as to whether or not Mr. Hawkins actually reaches into his pocket, already has his hands in his pocket. All those issues, as the Court of Appeals, and you can see in their opinion, have resolved against me. The facts are what they are. I am not able to argue all those conflicts for lots of good reasons, but I'm here now because what the statute requires is that he be in possession of 10 or more counterfeit bills, and that he knows they're counterfeit, and that he intends to utter them or pass them off as good. And that's exactly where we get to at this point. And let me just address the issues. And I don't want to dismiss possession, but if we agree that possession is not my strongest argument, I'll move on to the other two, which really have to do with his knowledge and the intent to utter. The police recover 18 bills. They're 20s. They're divided up in four different groups. Each group, three in one group, four and five, different group numbers. They all have the same serial number in that one group. So there are four different groups and four different numbers. The officer who recovers them gives them to an evidence officer. They go through all the booking, and eventually what happens is the officer who has the bills after they get to headquarters calls the arresting officer, Smaglo, and says, I don't know about these bills. Come down and take a look. They come down, they look at them, and then they go through and discover that they are what they suspect at that point is counterfeit. So by this time, they've gone from Big Daddy's, where they were picked up, into the hands of a police officer, into the hands of another police officer, placed in property and evidence, and now they're reviewed, and at this point, after numerous people have handled them, they think, yeah, I've looked at them, and maybe they're counterfeit. So when we get to whether or not Mr. Hawkins knew, the police did not know when they apprehended him and when they picked up the bills. They didn't know. They didn't know later at headquarters when they booked him, and obviously they had to count the inventory, the contraband, or whatever evidence they had to inventory. They didn't understand it was counterfeit at that point. So it's not, in that sense, obvious. And if you look at the cases that talk about the counterfeits, and particularly the federal cases, because that's where the counterfeit law really lies, one of them, they generally talk about the quality of the bills being so poor that you can easily spot them. And here, the expert who testified, Mr. Apperson, he was with the...
Can I stop you just for a second? Sure. What about the fact that the defendant, according to the police officer, threw the money down when he saw the police officers there, and then afterwards the police says, oh, you dropped your money. He says, it's not my money. It's not my money. He says, why wouldn't you want your money? I mean, isn't that kind of indicative of the fact that he thought there was something wrong with the bills because he didn't want anybody to think that they belonged to him?
Well, that is an issue of fact that got resolved against the defendant as to whether or not he, in fact, actually dropped them. When the police officer says, when Smaglo says to Ha, the other police officer, this is Hawkins' money. At that point, they're outside the building, they're getting ready to go into the car. He says, that's not my money, because is he talking about the money that he dropped or didn't drop, the money that was picked up, or some other money? There's no clear indication that it ties the money together. But even beyond that, that is only one of the evidences or indicia of whether or not he possesses with the intent to utter. And if you go through the federal cases, and I'll just, if I may, state for you what I believe are the things that the courts look at. And the cases cited by the Attorney General in United States versus Armstrong talking about what it takes to be counterfeit, okay? the possession and the passing alone in U.S. versus Higgins, that's not enough. You've got to have some mens rea. That doesn't equal it. Possessing it doesn't, and actually passing it doesn't. But you talk about a rapid series of passings where you go very quickly within a very short space of time and you pass. Or you do it at different establishments. You make small purchases with larger bills. You use a 50 to buy $2 worth of goods, something like that. The money is segregated. The bad money, the counterfeit, is different from the good money. And then you have abandonment of the money. That is one of the indicia. And then you also have a large number of bills. This is clearly set out as one of the indicia when you have a lot of counterfeit money. And I think actually in the King, in the Mitchell case, or in King case, had 72 $5 bills, and they talk about a large number of bills. There's 18 here. And then they talk about being passing the money at a commercial establishment, and I think that one clearly doesn't affect, because that's the only place you're going to use counterfeit money. Where else would you use money except at a commercial establishment, someplace where cash transactions occur? You're not going to pass money by putting it into an ATM as a deposit. I mean, that's not going to happen if you know it's counterfeit. But of those things that the federal courts look at as indicia of intent to utter, none apply here except the potential abandonment. There were no rapid series of transactions. He was not in different locations. He did not make small purchases. In fact, there's no evidence that he made any purchase or that he used the money for any commercial transaction. He's just there. We can talk about what he's doing there, but that's not the issue. There's no commercial transaction. There was no segregation of the money from good money. He didn't have this in one pocket, this in another pocket, or some of it banded together, or even folded separately, as the cases talk about. In fact, when they talk about the mixing of the bills, the U.S. cases, the federal cases, U.S. versus Barrows, says that the government there, in their case, relied on the fact that the bills were mixed together with other bills. Whereas in the King case and the other case, they talk about them having segregated. So the federal government is going to have it both ways. You segregate them or you put them together. Somehow, both of those become indicia of intent to utter. The whole point being here, when you look at the case law in Virginia, you get out a magnifying glass, you're not going to see anything. You have an unpublished opinion in our case. You have another unpublished opinion. There's just basically no real guidance here for the courts, much less for the defense bar. And I would argue that based on the inconsistent cases in the federal system, there's not really any guidance for the prosecution. The Commonwealth's attorneys are left in the lurch, I believe, also. They don't really know what they're charging. We understand that almost all cases of counterfeit are prosecuted by a United States attorney. So it's rare that we get one here. I think that the circumstances for getting this case to trial were unique. Mr. Hawkins was known to the police. He was on outstanding warrants for other offenses. They got a good tip. They did good police work. They go and arrest him. But as they walk in, we have all that conflicting evidence. Once again, it was resolved against me about whether or not the police came in, you know, with guns open, or whether or not he said, take your hands out of your pocket, all that. That's irrelevant. The only point in any of the cases that point toward an intent to utter is the fact that he perhaps dropped them onto the floor and then denies ownership. But that is the only thing, and I think at best that would be explainable, and we've explained that. Whether it's the facts or not, we don't know, because there is no evidence of that in a trial. But the point is, if he is in fact carrying money that he does not want to claim, he's in Big Daddy's, which is a known location for underworld activity. That's the best we can call this place in Portsmouth. It is well known. It is known to everyone in Portsmouth for that. Gambling goes on. Illegal drug sales go on. prostitution goes on, everything in the world goes on in and around that establishment and its immediate environs. It is not at all unbelievable that he discards the money believing that he is somehow in possession of marked bills from some drug buy that maybe he was involved in previously and he doesn't want to get involved in that, or he was selling and now he's got some marked bills and he's on a sting and he's going to get busted now for a drug thing. It could have been prostitution money that he comes to acquire. Once again, marked bills that he's going to be prosecuted for. It could certainly have been money for a gambling debt. And once again, Portsmouth has gone after the poker as hard as any city in the Commonwealth and busting up the poker rings. Clearly, this man had a lot of incentive to get rid of legitimate money because there's no evidence that it was not legitimate money because it took an expert to come and testify as to that, as to the type of money. And if you look at Sidrith, which is one of the unpublished opinions from the Court of Appeals, they cite Carlton versus Commonwealth for, you know, knowledge, which is one of those elements that we have that the Commonwealth has to prove. And in Carlton, this the Court of Appeals said that the Commonwealth failed to prove knowledge because it required an expert to testify that the lottery ticket in question was in fact altered or was a bogus lottery ticket. It took an expert to testify that. And so they said that even with that expert testimony, because it required expert testimony, you couldn't prosecute this guy. You failed on the knowledge. How would he know if it took an expert to tell? Well, that's exactly what happened here. It took an expert to tell. He goes through all the stages and all the different things that talk about the good money, the type of paper, the ink, whether or not it's printed correctly or if it's printed incorrectly, versus the engraving, the serial numbering, all of those things. Clearly, it took a trained individual as an expert to define this as a counterfeit bill. How that is different from what the Court of Appeals had previously said in Carlton somewhat escapes me, because if it takes an expert on that and you eliminate knowledge, I don't see that Mr. Hawkins here is held to that knowledge standard here, much less to the intent to utter. I want to reserve a little bit of time, but I want to make one other point here in regard to the differentiation between the federal statute and the state statute. The Attorney General cites the statutes on page 16 of the brief, but if this court will review its opinion in Smith versus Commonwealth at 282 Virginia, 449, just in 2011, that was a case about false information for the purchase of a gun, in which it said that talking about a cognate but different statute, the state statute and the federal statute, cognate but different statutes on scienter for the purchase of a firearms, the Supreme Court here used a stricter Virginia standard of scienter. All that means is, if you look at the standards, there's no intent to utter. There's nothing there in the federal statute. It's a different and higher standard in Virginia. It was used in Smith versus Commonwealth. I know that this court takes seriously its prerogative and its privilege to interpret its own statutes and doesn't rely on federal interpretation and analogy. It's certainly there and helpful, but it's not dispositive in this case. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Victoria Johnson, and I represent the Commonwealth. Your Honors, the evidence was sufficient to prove the required elements of the offense in this case. Here, the defendant, and again, I'll concentrate as opposing counsel did on the knowledge and intent elements. Here, the expert testimony in this case was that these bills indeed bore repeating serial numbers, but were also printed on non-currency paper, lacked color-shifting ink, and bore the tiny pink, blue, and yellow dots indicative of inkjet printing. Furthermore, the defendant's actions when he was approached by police are indicative that he knew that he bore counterfeit currency. And it's true, the Commonwealth has relied on federal cases because those are the cases that are available. We are arguing by analogy to the federal cases because those are helpful to the court. We believe those are helpful to the court, and they were helpful in the Court of Appeals. And as the federal cases state, one of the strongest indicia of knowledge is the attempt to abandon or destroy counterfeit currency when detection is feared. As the police approached, and the conflicts in the evidence were resolved in the favor of the Commonwealth at the trial court, those are factual findings, the defendant placed his hand in his right pocket, would not take his hand out of his right pocket, even though the officer commanded him to do so at gunpoint twice. And when he finally took his hand out of his pocket, he did so and threw 18 $20 bills. That is the kind of furtive behavior and odd behavior that is indicative of guilty knowledge. That evidence is about an app, Appendix 56 to 57. That was Detective Smaglow's testimony. That is all evidence from which the fact finder could draw the conclusion that the defendant knew that he had counterfeit currency. My opposing counsel has cited the Carlton case from the Court of Appeals that was mentioned in the Sidreth opinion. I apologize, I don't have that citation readily available for the court because it wasn't cited in my brief. However, I do recall the case. In that case, a lottery ticket, someone who bore a forged lottery ticket went to cash in the ticket. The court found that the evidence was insufficient to convict her of uttering a forged lottery ticket because she, essentially, the court found she didn't know that it was forged. Her demeanor when she went to turn in the ticket to cash it in was not the demeanor of someone who was trying to get away with something. She was perfectly calm. She was excited to have won, I think it was $20 or $50. It was a small amount of money. She was excited to have won some money, but she wasn't acting in a guilty manner, in a manner that would suggest to a finder of fact that she was committing a fraud. And in addition to those facts in Carlton, the expert testified that to the forgery of the ticket, it was very difficult to tell. You really did have to get out a magnifying glass in that case. On the contrary, the forged currency in this case was on non-currency paper and bore those tiny pink, blue, and yellow dots indicative of inkjet printing. And I submit that is somewhat noticeable. Going to the intent to utter element, if the court doesn't have any questions regarding knowledge, going to the intent to utter element, Your Honors, the defendant carried a fairly large amount of forged $20 bills, 18 $20 bills, together. There was no genuine currency mixed in, we know that from the testimony, in his pocket to a commercial establishment. There's no indicia in the record that he was going there for any other purpose but to a commercial establishment where one would engage in small cash transactions. That is evidence from which a reasonable fact finder could find the intent to utter. And for those reasons, we submit that the evidence was sufficient. If the court has questions, I'm happy to answer them. If not, the Commonwealth will rest on its brief and ask you for. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
May it please the court. Just very briefly, let me just address the two or three issues here. On the indicia of the counterfeit nature of the bills, and the tiny dots, and the quality of the paper, once again, the defense position is that that's not something that an ordinary individual would recognize. There was some discussion about this is just like a throwdown drug case. Not so. Everyone knows drugs are illegal, and they come packaged when you get them on the street in a way that doesn't look like they came from a pharmacy in a bottle with a little prescription label on it. So everybody knows that. It's not the same thing as the throwdown, discard the drug cases. So I don't think that analogy applies whatsoever. I think what happens here is when you talk about guilty knowledge and tossing on the floor and demeanor, if you look at the federal cases at U.S. versus Armstrong, the bike riders, motorcycle guys, use $20 bills to buy less than $2 worth of soft drinks, something at a pharmacy, and some bike parts at a hardware store, all for less than $2. Very calmly went in, just like the lady with the lottery ticket. People that are passing counterfeit bills are going to do it calmly. They're not coming in saying, I got a funny bill, give me change. So the demeanor here, there is nothing to talk about my client's demeanor whatsoever in passing the bills. There is no evidence that he passed any bills.
Thank you. Your time has expired.
All right. Thank you very much.
Call the next case, please.